it says Christ our Passover sacrifice for us, they'll accept that the Passover was a type of Christ. But if we try to say that Joseph was a type of Christ in 100 different ways, they'll say nonsense, you know.
In this month's Moody magazine, they have an article on cutting the word straight. And they don't see any connection between the Song of Solomon and the rise of Christ. Take Joshua completely, you know, as a historical book and no application to the
That's exactly what's the problem, spiritual blindness.
Yeah.
No, and it's oftentimes a willing blindness. Sometimes what happens is if a person gets into a legalistic mode, they will be reticent to do anything that they can't see in black and white ink on the page. In other words, they're just a real fear that they might be launching out into the dark someplace, you know. But they misunderstand what typology is. You're not teaching doctrine from types. It's just observation of patterns and a recognition of the design and intent of the scripture and so forth. It's if you see it properly, that shouldn't bother you at all. You know, you can have your letter and still have the spirit too.
It's a national Christian publication like Moody.
Mm-hmm. That was in Moody, huh?
Yeah, rejecting anything.
Yeah, that's funny.
Thinking, you know, that they're wrong to even look at any other. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think some of them, you know, have been stung in the past by people who went way overboard. And, you know, in church history, there were people who went into lots of wild allegorical interpretations, and they did go to extremes. And then what happens oftentimes is a person sees that, and then he reacts fully the other way, and they never see a balance in between.
So bring
the baby up and down. Yep, precisely.
And it's funny, you know, that would be an interesting historical study for somebody to do, or just to study various denominations and their viewpoints on things like that. Just out of curiosity. You know, we looked at various denominations and sectarian doctrines to try to get ideas of, you know, what the different groups teach and so forth, but it'd be interesting to kind of, if somebody could do it, you know, make phone calls around to various, you know, ministers, seminaries, things like this, just to see what their views are, just as an objective observer, you know, and then compile the data and see what's going on out there. Because really, well, apart from things, smatterings of things like that we hear from now, you know, it's hard to know what's going on out there. As far as most of them don't do much exegesis, period, so you don't really see, you know, the issue come up. Okay. Well, we want to finish this lesson 41 exercise first and then get into 42 on the subordinating conjunctions. So to pick up where we left off, I think we did three. We did three already. Okay. Number four then, and who did three yesterday, Eric? Okay, Glenn, you want to take number four? Just read the Greek and then translate.
We're in somewhere. Here we go. Check around the tape.
Good.
The scribes sought the Lord and the Pharisees found the disciples.
Right. The scribes sought the Lord and the Pharisees found the disciples. And if you wanted to, I put that in parentheses too, just in case. The scribes sought the Lord, but the Pharisees found the disciples. That'd be all right too, except however is usually a little stronger. You know, you. Again, it's just a matter of context. Dad is just a little weaker, you know. It's not a real strong. As long as you don't make it a real strong, however, make it a light one. Okay. I don't know how to describe it. Yeah. Intonation pattern is mainly the way you're going to express that. And it isn't a big leap. If you said however on a test, I wouldn't count it wrong. But I suppose the difference is, see, if you really got a strong however or a but or something or nevertheless, you usually have Allah there where you're really drawing attention to that, making a real big contrast. Da is usually, you know, a less of a contrast. There can be a contrast there, but it's not a real strong one. You can even get it from, in something like this, just if you translate it but, you'll see that the scribes sought the Lord but the Pharisees sought the disciples. And it's not really laying a gigantic emphasis on a huge contrast. But it could be there. It could be seen. Okay, some of this is going to come as you see this more and more, and then you'll begin to sense the difference there. All right, number five, Mark.
Why men divisit on Tom Curion, why the Huron to Monday.
Right.
Some sought the Lord, but others found the disciples.
Right, good.
Others found the
disciples. Mm-hmm. Question?
Well, just as a general thing, like in number four, in English, normally we would call that a run-on sentence because the two ideas that are not necessarily related unless we wanted to make, wanted them to be specifically related. Now, in Greek, I have a feeling that they just run-on sentences, period, like in Hebrew, you know, with little or no stopping in between.
Mm-hmm.
So, is there, in other words, if we see that in there, or is it just because that's the way they're going to write, or is it because they are trying to draw some intimacy or distinction?
Well, des you're usually going to be, des will commonly be used in the position that the Hebrew would use a walk consecutive, for example. Now, you'll see des more often used that way than you'll see chi, because it's got this transitional, you know, this continuity or flowing type of an idea. When you see a long dissertation and things are conjoined together, you'll often see des over and over again, all the way down running through it. It kind of ties things together without drawing too much attention to itself. Without drawing too much attention to the word debt, you know, it's not shouting at you, but it is making a connective and a flow. However, in addition to that, there may be on occasion, because of the nature of the clauses and the context, a slight contrast in play. The same thing happens in Hebrew while consecutive. And in Hebrew, if you see the word and then it's broken up with something nonverbal or something, then you'll see a disjunctive type of situation, and that kind of thing can happen here for different reasons. You have a different language here, but the same kind of feeling can be seen there, and it's usually in terms of the syntax and the relationship of the clauses that may cause you to translate it, but, or sometimes you may see it at the beginning of a new paragraph or something, and you may just say, now this happened, and so forth, or and then, rather than saying and, just to get a flow for it. But the word de will be all the way through there in Greek. So it's hard to say in some instances whether it's purely a Greek thing or whether a little bit of Hebrew thought's getting mixed in the New Testament, at least, with the usage of de. I suppose a person would have to examine pure Greek writings and compare them with the New Testament to see if there's any difference along those lines. I would guess, just on the surface, that you'd probably see more of a use of de in the New Testament than you would in classical Greek writing. But I haven't searched it out, but I would expect that, especially in narrative-type situations. So it is it's a connective, it's like chi, but it doesn't seem to have as much force in the sense that there's not as much attention drawn to the connective. The attention is more drawn to the flow of the thought. So I think your observation about the running of the sentences and so forth is fairly, it's right. It's the right kind of observation about what's going on. Okay. And it almost serves as, if you don't have punctuation in the original unseals and so forth, that debt helps you as far as punctuation. It helps you see how things are being connected. Once you recognize that it's postpositive, you know, that you have to look at the word just before it in order to see where the punctuation goes and get used to a few things like that, it probably would be a real helper for you in connecting things. Okay, we did number five. Was there any other questions on number five? Some sought the Lord, but others found the disciples, or the but isn't actually stated there. Hoi de would be the others, you see, in contrast. But there is a comma there, and you're probably going to put either but or and. Or just, you could just say, some sought the Lord, others found the disciples. That'd be fine. Number six, Christ. Okay.
Neither the scribes nor the Pharisees found the Lord.
Yes, good. Neither the scribes nor the Pharisees found the Lord. Okay, uta there being used as neither nor combination. Good. Number seven, Dale.
The Pharisees sought both the Lord and the disciples.
Good. Yes, the Pharisees sought both the Lord and the disciples. And you see here the chi coming before the whole construction. That's a tip-off that we've got a both and type construction. Those are really not difficult to identify when you see them. The first thing that will hit you is that chi just doesn't seem to fit in for the first one. And then you can say, oh, I better watch for another one. We're going to get a both-and type of situation. Okay. And the thing that tips you off, I suppose, any more than anything else, is that ezete sounds a verb, and then kai ton kurion, ton kurion is a noun. So you're not joining things of like kind, and that's going to immediately let you know that you've got something, a different type of construction here with kai. And you may not know for sure that it's going to be both and until you see the other and. It might be an also type of construction. You know, it could have been, depending on the rest of the sentence, it might have been something like, the Pharisee sought the Lord, the Pharisee sought also the Lord, or something like that, if it just ended right there. If the previous sentence had said, the Sadducees sought the Lord, and then the next one was, the Pharisees also sought the Lord, then you might have a construction like that. So you wouldn't necessarily know just by seeing the chi in a funny place just what kind of construction you had until you read the rest of the sentence. This is something typical about Greek. You almost have to read the whole sentence in order to know what it said. In English, you can kind of, because word order in English is pretty consistent, you know, you can start off and you kind of know where you are. Even if you get stopped in the middle, you know that the rest has got to be the object or something else. But in Greek, you may find the subject at the end. You may, you know, you have to kind of read all the way through to figure out what's being said. Okay, number 8, Greg. Good.
Not even the scribes sought the disciples.
Right, not even the scribes sought the disciples, okay? And Udeh there in this lead-off position like this would be best translated something like this. Not even the scribes sought the disciples. Okay, then number 9, Steve.
Udeh gar poi grammatis ezete san ton kurion udeh hoi.
Okay.
For neither the scribes sought the Lord nor the Pharisees found the disciples.
Okay, for neither the scribes sought the Lord nor the Pharisees found the disciples. Or if you wanted, I suppose you could do it this way too. For neither the scribes sought the Lord, neither did the Pharisees find the disciples. Or you might do something like that, but all you need is just that nor construction that he gave. Okay, and back to number 10, the last one, John.
Not only the scribes sought the Lord, but also the Pharisees found the disciples.
Good. Yes. Not only the scribes sought the Lord, or not only did the scribes seek the Lord, if you want to change the wording a little bit. Not only the scribes sought the Lord, but also the Pharisees found the disciples. Okay. Questions, anybody? I think you've got that pretty well. It's that chapter's kind of laborious because you're going through all of these constructions, but most of them, once you've been through them, you'll pretty much recognize them from here on out. They don't pose any giant problems as far as translation, at least in my experience. Okay, lesson 42, subordinating conjunctions. These also are not really difficult. Once you get the basic meaning of them, then you see them. In fact, a number of these mean about the same thing or used roughly the same way. Some of them are just longer forms and shorter forms of the same word and things of that nature. So remembering then our definition of a subordinating conjunction back on page 242, subordinating conjunctions connect clauses to other clauses in such a way that the one introduced by the conjunction functions as a subordinate constituent of the other, either as a subject, object, adverbial, adjectival modifier, adverbial modifier, and so forth. So the basic concept here of a subordinating conjunction is that it is introducing a clause that's going to somehow be a part of the previous clause, or it's going to be a slave to that previous clause somehow, and it functions as a constituent part of that. In many cases, it's going to be the subject or the object, or you know, the whole clause will function in that position, or maybe an adverbial modifier, the whole clause modifying the verbal idea that was introduced in the first one. Okay, so instead of having two clauses that are just standing independent and have no relationship to each other, except maybe just a coordinating conjunction, chi, or something between them, here we have one situation in which one clause is, in a sense, dependent upon the other, or it is helping define the other, or functioning as a constituent part of the other. And that distinction does get subtle in some instances. You know, you have to. Part of it is recognizing the kinds of subordinating and coordinating conjunctions. That may help you too in identifying the two. But that's part of what we're going to do diagramming. Why we're going to do diagramming is to help really discern the difference between things like this. Okay, so section 321. Subordinating conjunctions may be divided into two groups, those which are always or almost always followed by the indicative mood, and those which are always or almost always followed by the subjunctive mood. Now, the subjunctive mood we haven't gotten to yet, so we're going to get into that in lesson 45. So he's going to postpone that to lesson 45. And subjunctive is something we do have in English, but Greek's going to be using it a little bit more precisely and more frequently than we do. And oftentimes when in English you would have something in the indicative, in Greek it'll be in the subjunctive, especially when you're dealing with conditional clauses and things of that nature. The whole concept of conditional clauses and conditional situations lends itself very well to the subjunctive idea in Greek, so we're going to see that show up there. So we'll wait with that. But the most important, the ones we're going to be dealing with are those that are used with the indicative mood. The most important court subordinating conjunctions of the first group are hoti, dot, hos, kathos, hosper, kathaper, epe, epede, heos, hoste, and a. And a is going to be discussed more in lesson 45 in addition. Okay, first of all, hoti. Now, hoti is the most common subordinating conjunction. Depending upon its context, it means that or because. Now, if you look at the footnote here, you'll notice that hoti is identical in form with a neuter of the relative pronoun hostis. Remember that long form of the relative pronoun. In the neuter, it would be, in the neuter nominative or accusative, it would be hoti. So it's really the same as that, and as far as its form is concerned. Now, one thing that's remarkably different, though, is that as a subordinating conjunction, it needn't have an antecedent, at least not a specific antecedent. Sometimes it's possible to think of the antecedent as being a whole clause or something like that. It's a neuter concept idea. There may be a connection there, but I wouldn't press that too far. So think of it as a function word. Think of it as a subordinating conjunction, and it's translational. You can usually get by with either one of these, either that or because. And the context will have to decide which one it is, and there are some features of the context that help make that decision quite easy. As you'll see here, part A, hoti means that when the clause it introduces has the function of a substantive. Now, what's a substantive? Well, it's something that's functioning like a noun. So, in effect, you translated that when the clause that follows functions like a noun relative to this other sentence structure you set up. It may be the object, direct object. And that's going to be most common. It might be the subject. It might be object of a preposition or something like that. So anytime the whole clause is functioning as a substantive and as a constituent part of the other clause, then in that position, it's going to be translated that. It is especially common as a means of introducing indirect discourse. Now, indirect discourse is something like he said that such and such. And in effect, then, the whole thing that he said is the direct object of the phrase, of the introductory statement, he said. He said what? He said that, such and such and such and such, the whole clause. Now, you translated that because the whole clause is functioning as the direct object of the phrase, he said. Okay, so that's going to be one of the ways. Now, there's two examples here. The first one, elpizo gar hoti, hoti, excuse me, diaton prosuchon humon charisthesomai humin. For I hope that through your prayers I shall be granted unto you. Now notice your main sentence structure, I hope, elpizo, you've got the subject and object there, and then gar, of course, being postpositive, so it's for I hope. Now what does he hope? I hope, hoti, that, and then the rest of the entire phrase is the direct object of the verb hope. I hope such and such. So it's functioning as a substantive then. The entire clause is functioning as if it were a noun or as if it were, direct object of that verb hope. And therefore, we see hoti translated as that here. Now, it wouldn't fit to say, I hope because through your prayers I shall be granted unto you, really. That's not really the primary idea of that, although because is a proper translation of hoti in other circumstances, and you'll see that in part B. Now, Matthew 16:18, kago, if you haven't seen the word kago, I think we saw it in some of our translation or in John there, but it's the combination of kai plus ego. So they just abbreviated it to kago. So kago de soi lego hoti sue petros kai epi tau te 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 petra oikodomeso mu te nekoision. But I say it to you also that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. Now here he's introducing an indirect quotation. Now there is some debatable situations here. This could be considered a direct quotation also. In fact, there's really not much difference between an indirect and a direct quotation in Greek. I think we've seen some things to that effect earlier as far as the verb forms that are used. And he'll mention here in part C that it introduces, hoti will introduce direct discourse also, and then he favors not translating anything, just saying, you know, quote, putting quotation marks in. But you'll find that in very often it's going to be hard, apart from context is the only thing you really got to go on in deciding whether something's indirect discourse or direct discourse. If it's obviously a part of a conversation that's going on, you'll probably set it up as a direct discourse. If it's just an isolated statement that's referring back to a previous conversation or something that you can tell from the context, then you probably translate it indirect discourse. But the actual structure in the Greek isn't much different. Okay, and again, the structure is, but I say to you that, and the that is now introducing the whole clause, which stands as the direct object of the verb to say. So it's kind of a special case of this general idea of translation that, OT meaning that, as introducing a clause that functions as a substantive. Okay, then part B, in contrast to this, when you translate OT as because, is in a situation when the clause it introduces cannot have a substantive function and therefore must be adverbial. So if it's not substantive, it's going to be an adverbial clause. It's going to modify the verbal idea of the main sentence, or either the verbal idea, or it's going to give a temporal relationship or something. Usually it's going to give you some time or logical grounds or some basis, and hence the translation because for is the most common in situations like that. So ho ophthalmosu poneros esten hoti ego agathos emi. Is your eye evil because I am good? Now here hoti is introducing clause because I am good. Hoti ego agathos emi. It's here you probably wouldn't translate, is your eye be evil that I am good. There are some poetic uses in English, you know, where that can be used in situations like that, but it's usually very ambiguous and confusing when you do. You don't really see this cause and effect or ground-type construction, and that may be something that's worth avoiding, just so you don't confuse it with the other kind of construction. Because, you see, you do have a difference in grammatical construction between the description in Part A and Part B here. It's not a matter of just taking a wild guess as to which way you want to translate it. The structures are different. In Part A, the phrase in question is a substantive. It's functioning as a direct object in both those examples. In Part B, the phrase in question is not a substantive. You see, you have your complete thought already. Is your eye evil? And that'll stand by itself, and the predicate construction and so forth. And then because I am good, this is given as the grounds or the basis upon which the other statement is made. So translation because is appropriate. And like I said, you may not even consciously be thinking about the difference between these. As you're translating, it may be quite obvious which way you're going to have to translate hoti. If you run into a hoti, it's going to be either that or because, and the context will settle it. You may not even mentally be cognizant or consciously be cognizant of why you chose that, but this will usually be the reason. You choose one if it's a substantive, you choose another if it's not. Okay, then part C, hoti sometimes introduces direct discourse. When it does, it should not be translated, but merely represented by quotation marks. Hoti in this use is roughly equivalent to the English quote, as used by some speakers to indicate the fact that they're about to begin a quotation. Now, you've heard people, when you're giving a documented study or something like this, or a speech where you're quoting somebody, they'll go along and say so-and-so-and-so-so, and quote such-and-such, and use the word quote right there, and then so maybe say unquote afterwards to indicate that what they're saying is a direct quotation. And he's saying that that's kind of what has happened here with hoti. Hoti is almost like saying quote this, and leading into something of this nature as a direct quotation. But structurally, it's not much different than the indirect quotation, and so your context is going to have to be your guide in deciding whether it's direct or indirect. Notice the difference here. Kai legosin auto hoti patas zetusinse. They said to him, quote, everyone is looking for you, unquote. See, that's the idea. Okay, and sometimes there'll be enough in the actual statement, and it'll be so precise, so specific, that you'll say, well, it's got to be a direct quotation. So, like I said, sometimes context is going to, you know, is going to settle. But other times, the construction will be exactly the same for direct or indirect quotation, and then you'll have to just make up a decision and make a decision on that. Yes.
I think this bill is also supposed to be had an assignment in Matthew 2:23, and some commentators brought up that section A or B, or that it could be either the translated that or the cause.
Oh yes.
That it might be fulfilled.
Uh huh.
Or.
There may be some ambiguities as a result of the fact that a certain phrase might in fact fit as a substantive or as an adverbial modifier. In a situation like that, you know, guess what? It's back to context and so forth again. Okay? I think most of the time you're going to have a pretty clear distinction between those, just because the previous sentence structure is going to be sufficient. However, realize, too, that the potential ambiguities can come when, say, you have a verb, a subject and verb construction, and the thing that follows, it's a verb that can take a direct object, but it may not necessarily have a direct object. You know what I mean? The fact that a verb can take an object doesn't necessarily mean that it has to take an object. You could say, I saw the car, or you could just say, you know, I saw, and not have, you know, any direct object. And so if you have sentence structures like that, and you have a clause in question that's introduced by ho t, and if the clause could be adverbial, or it could be the direct object, then you may have some problem there. Now deciding which way I'm going to translate this. Okay. And that sometimes you may be forced to parallel passages or something else to try to decide the issue. Yes, Greg?
I was just wondering if you use the word substantive. I remember that previously, and I always kind of thought it meant the subject.
Oh, no. No, right. Substantive simply means that it functions like a noun. Now, very often that's going to be a subject. I think you're thinking maybe back in terms of participles and so forth. The most common way we saw a substantive participle was when it was the subject. But it could also be the direct object in the dative case. It could be in the accusative case, an indirect object in the dative case. Could be the object of a preposition and be in either dative or accusative or genitive. Could be genitive modifying phrase and so forth. So a substantive can function in any of those positions. Nominative, genitive, dative, or accusative. Okay? Just all it means is it's functioning like a noun. Something that's not a noun is acting like a noun. That, it could be true of an adjective, could be true of a whole clause like it is here. Participle, of course, which is kind of like an adjective. So, and even prepositional phrases sometimes can function as substantives. Yes?
Part A, which is 51, is operate, the whole clause follows OT.
Uh-huh.
Operating as a direct object of the verb. I was thinking, well, with those verbs that can take two direct objects, mm-hmm. two things in the accusative, you could have a direct object in a sentence and then this taking the second.
Yes, you could.
Could you also have, I mean, I'm trying to figure out the extent that you can load down the verb.
Right.
On the verb in the sentence, uh-huh. and still throw this on the end,
uh-huh.
being awkward or run up. So essentially, the verb is carrying three direct objects because one is under the routine.
Well, that can happen. You can have, it's not so much caring, but there may be another direct object and a whole sentence structure within the whole T phrase. So you may very well indeed have, I don't know if it would ever work out this way, but something that takes a double accusative or something, if each one of those double accusatives was a clause, you know, you could really have a big laborious...
Four or five or six.
Yeah, and then within each of those, and see, here's something else that happens. Within a subordinating clause that may be the direct object of a previous sentence, there may be, you can get steps, you know, its direct object may be another clause. And then the direct object of that one, theoretically, I mean, you could go ad infinitum. Of course, they don't get that laborious, but once we start diagramming, you'll see that you sometimes have to, you know, fill the whole blackboard with several stages, you know, of these things, because within another clause, within this clause that's dependent upon this one over here, you've got another clause within that, another clause within that, or phrases, and it can get rather complicated. Fortunately, you don't see that all the time, because to talk like that all the time gets very confusing. The person's really got to follow. But you'll find in Pauline epistles especially, there's going to be lots of this kind of thing where it's almost impossible to pick out a sentence that's totally independent, because it'll start out with some subordinating conjunction. Therefore, you know, it'll start. I mean, you look through even in the English, and so wherefore, therefore, however, since, you know, and it seems like any verse you pick is related to the verse before, and that one's related to the verse before, and that one's related to the verse before, and we'll just have to put dotted lines connecting it up to that one and connecting it down to that one, and then just deal with it as it is. So that's very interesting. But you introduce a good point there. These things can occur on several levels, and it can get rather complex.
What I'm getting a feeling for is whether the verb itself is limiting whether you can use "hoti" or not according to how many direct objects it can carry.
Oh, I see.
It's an extra direct object thrown on regardless of whatever else happened in your sentence.
No, not really. As far as this sentence structure, just looking at this one now, forgetting about double objects and so forth for the moment, this direct object is going to be the direct object of that verb. That whole phrase will be the direct object. There won't be another direct object for the verb unless that verb happens to take a double accusative or something like that. In other words, this whole phrase will be it. If not, you see, if you have another direct object there, then this phrase will probably usually be translated as part B here. It's no longer functioning as a substantive. It's not a constituent part of the previous clause because it already had its direct object stated. So this would have to be something like because then, and then an adverbial modifier to the whole thing. It's only, you see, if this thing is going to function as a direct object, for example, there won't be another direct object there, unless, of course, it happens to be a verb that takes an object complement or a double accusative or something like that.
So really, there's by putting "hoti" in the next sentence, that next sentence is integral to the first verb.
Mm-hmm, exactly. It's an integral part of it. In fact, when we diagram it, mark out our line, and we'll have our subject, and then verb, and then direct object here marking. And instead of having a word in the direct object position, we'll have this whole clause. Kind of put a line down here and draw the whole clause in, and that will occupy that position of the direct object. If we have something else occupying already that position, then this would be considered probably an adverbial modifier tied to the verb. And by the way, a phrase like a "hoti" clause, they didn't give any examples here. Both of these are more direct object, but it could be the subject of the verb. In other words, you could start out a sentence something to the effect that he was a man of God is the reason why he was chosen or something. The whole phrase, that he was a man of God, would be subject, functioning as the subject. That is the reason, see? And here we've got, this is the, and this is a predicate construction there. That he was a man of God was a powerful motivating factor or something. You can draw, set up situations like that. It can also be an object of a prepositional phrase. And then you could have, you know, in the fact that, or in that he did this, and you may have "hoti" and have the "hoti" introducing the object of the prepositional phrase. It can function any place that a noun can function, in other words, basically. You could find one of these clauses in any place that a noun can be found and introduced by "hoti." Okay? And believe me, you'll get plenty used to that when we start getting into diagramming and translating. All right, "hoti" is a very, very common word in Greek. Okay, those are the three basic uses of it then. Then number two, "dot." "Dot" is usually means because or for, but if the context permits, it may be rendered by therefore. And it's just adding "da" to "hoti." So it's in "da," of course, the idea of through, and the idea of, you know, cause or because or on the basis of and so forth is seen there, especially with, if you consider "dot" "ot" as maybe an accusative, and then putting "da" with the accusative, you kind of get this idea of cause and so forth. So because or for or therefore, depending on the context here. So it's very similar to "ot." It's used much less frequently. He says, after he gives the example here, it's in many respects a synonym. There is a footnote on that where DOT may also mean that, but this meaning is not required in the New Testament except possibly Romans 8:21, where OT may be the correct reading. Apparently there's a manuscript problem on that one. Okay, so a few examples here. Ego gar emiho elachistos ton apostolon DOT edioxa ten ecclesion to thou. For I am the least of the apostles because I persecuted the church of God. So DOT is getting, I think we remember, had the idea of through what, if you can think of it that way, through what, and that kind of gets the idea because, through what, or for through what reason, or on the basis of what reason, that gives you at least some sense of what is functioning here. Because is a pretty good translation of it. And then here's another one where it's translated therefore. DOT martyromai, you mean, poti katharos amin ami ho tu haimatos panton. Therefore I testify to you that I am innocent of the blood of everyone. Okay, there's a hoti introducing, this would be the direct object of this testifying. I testify to you. See, I testify, I is the subject, testify is the verb, to you is the indirect object, and then hoti is introducing the direct object, and then he's giving you his testimony. And then therefore is introducing the whole clause. So DOT, when it's translated therefore, is generally going to be either at the beginning of the whole sentence or beginning of the clause, because it's going to give this kind of an idea of consecution, and it's really got the same basic function as because. It's just kind of where it fits in the sentence and whether it makes sense to translate it one or the other. And again, you usually have a pretty good sense of that without really having to tell you much. When you see DOT, you'll be able to tell normally just from context whether you should translate it therefore or because, just on the basis of what it means in English. Okay, then thirdly, we have hos, which means as, and kathos. There's a longer form of it, hosper and kathaper, meaning just and or just as, just as or just as, are used like their English equivalents. English equivalents. Hos and kathos are much more common than the others. So hos and kathos, and then hosper and kathaper are synonyms apparently for at least what he says. Of course, I'm always a little suspicious of that, but it looks like two of these are shorter forms and then the other two are longer forms. Looking at the examples here, just a translation as will normally get you by, and then you may have to qualify a little bit by the context and so forth, but generally just translating it as is sufficient. You'll see all the way through these examples that's the case. So hoste epausato laulon epenphros simona, and as he stopped speaking, he said to Simon. So the idea of progressive action, or as something's going on, something else is going on, is very clearly indicated by this. We've already seen some constructions like the circumstantial participle and genitive absolute constructions where we were translating things as. And sometimes even in a situation like that, you'll see hos thrown in there just to make it unambiguous as the idea of as is being seen. Notice that hos frequently has the meaning while or when. And that's usually just combining the idea of as with time. You know, as this is going on or while this is going on. So if you're dealing with a temporal modifier, or the phrase is modifying the time relationship of the main idea, then the translation while, when, during, or something is going to be possible. So here, uhi he kardia hemon in Luke 24:32, kaiomene en humin, hos elale humin en te hodo. Was it not our heart burning within us as he spoke to us on the way? As he spoke to us on the way. Or you could say while he spoke to us on the way, or when he spoke to us on the way, indicating that. When sometimes is a little weaker, just because when is a little bit indefinite, it have more of a punctiliar idea, whereas this as seems to be more of a progressive. This host is indicating some progression that's going on. All right. I don't know if we'll read all the rest of these examples here. Kathos, at the top of the next page there, same kind of an idea, just a longer form apparently. Kathos, akuo krino, as I hear, I judge. Opsomatha auton kathos esten, we shall see him as he is. And hosper Another form translated the same way. Ekroxen phone megale hosper leon leon mukatai mukatai. He cried with a loud voice as a lion roars. So again, as it's a comparison. It's often, you know, used for setting up similes or comparisons this way, just like the English word like or as. Okay, and kathaper, same kind of thing. For as the body is one, has many members, and so forth. So kathaper, garto, soma, hen, estin. Now, comment down here, like host, the conjunctions kathos, hosper, and kathaper are sometimes correlated with adverbs. For example, kathaper with hutos, and here's a construction that's similar, you know, host and hutos. As this, that, you know, thus this, you see. At 1 Corinthians 12:12, he gives his example above there. So kathaper, and then further on down there, hutos, kai ho, Christos, the last clause. So also is the body of Christ. So as this, so is this. It's a common combination of adverbs for the purpose of describing a comparison and so forth. Okay. He says they may be regarded as relative adverbs themselves when they have assignable functions within the clauses they introduce. So these other adverbs that are often used, once you start at a structure like this, they can also gain a functional meaning. They've got a lexical meaning as it is, but they may gain a functional meaning now because of the relationship of the clause that went before and the way that the word was set up there. So some of these other adverbs get brought into constructions like this, and they begin to gain certain functional meanings because of the thing that was set before them. Jim?
Could you translate just or after?
Just after? Well, just as is a possible translation, too. He's given that as a possibility. You could say, just as the body is one and has many members, so also is Christ. You know, it doesn't seem to have a lot of difference, except maybe a slight difference in aspect or emphasis. And apparently that information isn't really being gained from the word itself. It's mainly from the context and the kind of a feeling that person has who says it. So that's a possibility. You know, you could go up here for cover, just as I hear, I judge, or we shall see him just as he is. It's just that in English, when you put the word just in there, it seems to give more precision to it, more specifics. You know, we shall see him just as he is, not just as he is, but just as he is. And I'd be a little careful of translating it that way if all you had is one of these words. You may want to reserve that for situations in which the context and other things are making it very specific. Okay, and then, yes, Greg.
I just kind of reiterate what you said. It seems like there is a little difference in the way these others are used. It's where he's kind of drawing some parallels with Kathos, rather than when they're just using hose, it's just as kind of, you said, an indefinite statement.
Yes.
Am I seeing that right?
Well, I think so. I think that my general feeling is, and we've seen this over and over again, that if you've got a whole bunch of words and they're all being translated the same thing, watch for some differences. There's a difference on some level. Now, for example, kathos, you can see kata plus host there. Kata is down, so as down. Well, that may not make a lot of difference, but it just gives us a feeling of a little bit more precision. And if I was going to translate anything just as, it might be kathos, just as I hear a judge. You see, it's got a little bit more to it than just as. Now, to really refine this, though, with confidence, a person would have to map out the usages. In fact, I would certainly approve this as part, if you want to do this as an assignment, as your assignment for the term here next semester, this would be an excellent one. If there, you know, there may not be enough usages of some of these others to draw big conclusions. That's the only problem you might have. But if somebody wants to take a look in the concordance and see how many times each one of these is used, if they're used, you know, 10, 15, 20 times, you probably have enough to glean a pretty good a distinction. And check all the sources and so forth, check all the books, and then do some of your own checking and see what you can come up with on that. I would most welcome an analysis of something of that nature, because I suspect there is a slight difference. Sometimes those differences aren't real easy to translate, but if we can see them and feel them, it's really worth our time. Okay, maybe John's checking it there just to see what looks like a possibility. So check host and kathos. Well, maybe check host is going to be a lot of times anyway, but kathos and maybe kathaper and hostper, just to see what it looks like. It'd be worth someone doing it. If it's only used two or three times, you're probably going to be harder pressed to do anything.
It's just used about
80 times. Oh, good. Okay, there should be plenty of data there. Okay. Hospair and Kafapair, they may not be quite as frequent, but you can probably check Kafapair at least there. See what you got for that. Yeah, host will be real frequent. Okay, well, that's enough to at least... it looks plausible, then, for someone to pursue that and see if there is a distinction. Oh, more than I thought. Okay, good. So there's a good one for somebody, if you like. I'd kind of like to do some of these studies. We've done a lot of the prepositional studies in the past, and these we haven't done. So just a little hint there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We're running into all kinds of good topics for this. All right, then moving on for number four here, epe and epe de correspond to English since, usually not in a temporal sense, or in the idea of because. Now, the word since can be used in English, you know, this happened since that happened. That gives you that temporal sense, you see, in time, showing a time relationship and a time sequence of events. Also, we use the word since in the sense of because. He did this. And since he was high priest that year, he prophesied, something like that. There, it's not so much temporally related as it is cause related, and that's the kind of a function that epe and epe de have. Rather than a time function, they're using it in a cause type function. So the translation because or since in the sense of cause and effect is fine. So here, pos estai tuto epe andra ugenosco. How shall this be, since I do not know a man? Okay, since or seeing as how, or because I do not know a man. See, on the ground that I do not know a man. Yes?
Now I'm thinking back to the circumstantial participles.
The circumstantial participles? Okay.
Where the Hebrew tried to presume that that meant because, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see a participle in this direct object position?
Usually you won't see that. You see, what you'll see is one or the other, either using a participial construction, a circumstantial participial construction, or using one of these subordinating conjunctions. See, a subordinating conjunction is setting off something in the indicative mood. It's going to be, you know, at least these, and we'll see some with the subjunctive. But they are setting up a clause structure that is having its own finite verb and subject and object and so forth. So they've got at least a different grammatical format. You wouldn't see a mix between epe, for example, and a circumstantial participle. You either see one or the other. Now, you might see a construction. This sentence could also be stated using a circumstantial participle. Then you wouldn't have epe there. You'd just have, you know, a participial phrase, and then, you know, putting gnosko in a participial form and so forth. But that would be less precise because, you see, we talked about this before. The circumstantial participle is not necessarily implying cause. It's only implying a circumstantial action taking place, or this is going on at the same time as this, or something of that nature. And that would not necessarily indicate a strong cause. So if you want to get this cause idea, epe is one of the ways to do it. Use one of these subordinating conjunctions and remove the ambiguity. And there'll be some examples. We'll see with relative. We've talked about relative pronouns. We've already seen that you can convert relative pronoun construction to a participial construction under certain circumstances, and vice versa. And the same is going to be true now with some of these. But the difference is that these are using finite verb forms, regular declined verb forms, either in the indicative or later in the subjunctive, with certain types of subordinating conjunctions, and it's a different grammatical construction, and it lends itself to a little bit more precision than, say, a circumstantial participle. Sometimes if you don't want a lot of precision, if you purposely don't want a lot of precision, you may use a participle construction. If you want precision, you use one of these. And you can see that the language has got quite a diversity of ways to do things. And sometimes we're translating in English, the English translation is coming out the same way, whether it's a participial construction or whether it's a relative pronoun construction or whether it's a subordinating conjunction construction. And that makes for a little confusion, I suppose, but in the Greek you get some more precision this way. And so we want to try to make the distinctions as we can, as we go, so we can see that there's a reason why it was written this way, and this has got a certain nuance that the other one didn't have, and that's worthy of observation. Okay, epe day, there's another one. You can check between epe and epe day. That one may just be a shortened form. Epe just may be a shortened form of epe day. But again, that's worth maybe looking into. For since by man came death, you see, epe de garti di anthropu thanatos. Okay, and then heos means until or while. The combination heos hotu has the same meanings. Okay, we still got a few minutes. Both heos and heos hotu also occur with the subjunctive. So we're going to get to that a little bit. What was that?
And.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, I didn't even notice that. Yeah, you probably got so confused writing all these things. And, that's a good point. So you can make a correction in your book if you want there.
Oh, yeah.
Huh? Both and, right? That's what he should have had. Kaidea. All right. This one's pretty straightforward. It's pretty much a lexical type of thing. Heos eilthen ho kataklysmos, until the flood came, until the cataclysm came. Heos hemera esten, while it is day. So the translation of whether it's until or while, it's got the idea of duration either way. And I suppose that it kind of depends on whether you're focusing on the point at the end of the duration, in which case you'd say until, or if you're focusing upon the duration itself, in which case you'd say while. So it's going to depend on the context. And the idea, I think there may be an idea to this heos in the Greek, that to them it's just one word and it just means one thing. And that meaning plus context is what gives you your total meaning. And in English, we have to split it up into two different words in order to convey those two meanings. Okay. Heos hotu, they're translating the same way, until. And again, one might check to see if that's got a little bit more emphasis, a little bit more precision or what to it. We'd have to check and see how many times it's used. Apparently, it's used some, so... I would guess it to have a slightly different connotation, but or you know more precise or something. But it doesn't strike me as obvious at this point. Then number six, hoste, so that, hoste. That's usually indicating the result. You see, and again, if context permits, it may mean therefore, which is also akin to that idea of indicating result. So hutos gar agapisen hote oston kosmon hoste ton huion ton monogene. Edoken. For God so loved the world, so that he gave his only son. So here's the hoste then, so that. Or possibly, God so thus loved the world, therefore he gave. That's a possibility as well. Then hoste kurios esten ho huios tu anthropu kai tu sabbatu. Therefore the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath also. Okay. So the idea of so that or therefore. Even there, you could translate, so that the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath also. In other words, I've said all this so that you'll know that the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. It's got a similar idea. It's just the English translations, I think, that mainly are giving us different translations because our constructions are flow more freely with one type of wording than the other. Yes, Glenn?
According to what you said, time is, it seems to me that what the same... What the sentence is saying is, therefore, the Lord is the Son of Man and of the Sabbath.
Well, that's a possibility here. You could take this. It depends on which way you're looking at the phrases, which way you break up. You see, genitive phrases will often get you in trouble this way, just because they're used so frequently and. Sometimes you can get two of them in conjunction that one of them is modifying this other noun and the other one is modifying the genitive noun. And so that's not exactly what happens here, but genitive phrases can sometimes be ambiguous this way, just because they can be applied several different ways. In other words, what you could do here...
Maybe the
Sunday
and the Sabbath
are
right.
Yeah. Well, the Son of the Sabbath. The Son of the Sabbath, okay. Well, usually because I think the point is that Sabbaths don't have sons, at least not in the same sense that men have sons. And so that's the reason for breaking it up that way. In other words, the difference would be taking ho huios tu anthropou and making that phrase the Son of Man, and then the kai taking also joining a unlike grammatical units, joining really estin with sabbatu, and then having to translate it also. The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath also, the way they've done it. Or